Chairman, and I must race through this in the time allocated. But I was instructed to talk about Sylvester Horn Revisited. So I begin with a proof of celebrity. On the 7th of January in 1911, a woman's weekly, Mrs. Bull, published an open letter addressed to a congregational minister, the Reverend Sylvester Horn, MA, MP, London. I will read it in full. Dear sir, it is not so very long ago that you told a rather surprised world that women are not so capable of spirituality as men. That they are naturally obedient, but materialistic, and that the higher flights of spiritual possibility are denied them, etc., etc. We were a little taken aback, some of us, especially as our innate religious tendency is by many of your gallant sex often thrown in our teeth as a reproach. But now we shall all be calmed again by a practical demonstration of your own ideas of the spiritual which you have kindly given us. I understand that after the general election, when you were successful in contesting a Kentish division, you were present at a Thanksgiving service in a local chapel at which was a hymn sung to the tune of the Men of Harley. The fine old national hymn concludes with the words, Cambria, God and Right. I understand that your hymn concluded each verse with the same refrain, only with a significant alteration, as with God and Right. Please note the position occupied by the deity. I have yet, sir, to meet the woman who could use a chapel, a place made sacred by the prayers of the poor, if by no other consecration, as a theatre for the glorification of party feeling. The most militant of our ladies would not so exploit divine service, I'm thinking. Sir, we'd really rather not have that source of spiritual sense. We'd rather have enough sense of humour to keep the Prime Minister, whoever he may be, out of our hymnology. Mary Bull. Now, it would be hard to beat Mary Bull for inaccuracy and nonsense. But it would be hard to better her letter for hatchet job journalism. It is a masterpiece of insinuation. Every word counts, most tell, the hits are palpable. A week later, John Bull backed Mary Bull up with an imaginary interview. One of its journalists, Walter Moore, had managed to meet Mr. Horn. The celebrity status, you see, has been confirmed. And the character is ripe for assassination. Again, I give it in full. Having resurrected an ancient frock coat, donned a turned-down collar and narrow white tie, and borrowed a discarded black soft felt hat of more or less orthodox shape from a clerical friend, I assumed a look of woe, and made my lugubrious way to Whitfield's in the Tottenham Court Road. Friend, I said, accosting the first person I met in the building, whether deacon, doorkeeper, or ordinary sinner, I know not. Friend, will you do me a Christian kindness? Sorry, I haven't any money on me. Was the hasty reply of my interlocutor, trying to release himself from the clutch of my black glove hand. Oh, friend, I exclaimed, raising my eyes in approved revival fashion, be not hasty in thy judgment. I do not covet thy cash, but I would beg thee to direct me to Mr. Horn's private rooms, office, parlour, or whatsoever thou callest it. I desire to hold sweet converse with him. Oh, I see, returned my new friend, evidently much relieved. Come this way. 2 minutes later, I stood in the presence of the politico preacher, the doughty and renowned Sylvester Horn, M.P. Mr. Horn raised his somewhat saturnine face, if I may be permitted to use the expression, and fixed his penetrating eyes upon me. Good day, brother, he said. Did you wish to see me? Should I be here else, I asked, with painful reproof expressed in my raised forefinger. I suppose not, retorted Mr. Horn. can only give you 5 minutes. I am very busy.
Huh?
5 minutes will be more than enough. I was afraid it might be longer. I'm afraid I can't quite follow you, observed Mr. Horn, a hint of impatience in his tense voice. But I venture to remind you once more that I am a busy man. Yes, brother, I acquiesced. Too busy. Too busy, said the reverend politician. What do you mean? Brother, I replied, you are overtaxing your strength. The back is fitted to the burden, returned Mr. Horn complacently. But the process frequently gives rise to the hump. Your conversation is very strange, said Mr. Horn quietly, but with an ominous gleam in his eye. If you have business with me, please state it. The 5 minutes have already dwindled to 3. Thank goodness, I replied. The time flies faster than I had hoped. Now business. What do you mean by bracketing Mr. Asquith's name with that of the deity in a hymn sung at a Thanksgiving service held in a chapel in your division after the election? Mr. Hall rose to his full height, which is considerable. I rose to mine, which is not inconsiderable. You are a wolf in sheep's clothing, declared the political parson, running his eye rapidly over my get-up. Bah, I retorted, asserting my woolly character. What do you mean by countenancing such an impious, not to say blasphemous line as Asquith, God and Right, in a hymn sung at a chapel meeting called to celebrate your victory and to gloat over the defeat of your opponent? I have received no remonstrance from Mr. Asquith, said Mr. Horn, roughly, so do not see why you should concern yourself about it. At this point, my indignation mastered me. Man, I shouted, pointing the finger of scorn, you drag the name of the Most High into the mire of a petty box and cox party political contest, couple it with the name of a party politician, and when I remonstrate, you say Asquith has not complained. You self-sufficient humbug, you dare to regard the Almighty as the peculiar possession of your own ephemeral and egotistical religious sect. What audacity! What? See here, brother, interrupted the political pulpiteer, trembling violently. I may not strike you, but I should very much like to. I turned away with disgust. Well, so might we. This is caricature, but effective caricature has to be recognizable. And this imaginary interview is certainly recognizable. An unappealing chapel setting, the whiff of political dissent, the humbuggery of the free church conscience, and then the sight and the sound, doughty and renowned, of a pulpiteer. Every aspect that made that man so memorable, every circumstance that made him seem heroic, is here traduced. A man has been diminished. But then, as every journalist knows that every reader knows, there can be no smoke without a fire. And John Bull was the product of journalistic genius. It would make the fire if it had to. Its proprietor, Horatio Bottomley, was a fellow Liberal MP. He had entered Parliament for South Hackney and started John Bull in the same year, 1906. His was the unacceptable face of Liberal England. In 1911, he collapsed into bankruptcy. 1922, he would be sentenced to penal servitude for 7 years. He would serve 5 of them, and in the course of this, a prison visitor came across him sewing mailbags. Ah, Bottomley, sewing, I see, he said unimaginatively. No, Bottomley replied, reaping. That lay in the future. In 1911, though riding for a fall, one of many, and not the first, Bottomley still rode high. Horn could not let this pass. He issued writs against John Bull and Mrs. Bull. Moreover, this congregational minister had enviable legal connections. His father-in-law was master of the roads. His solicitors, Waterhouse and Co. of the City and Lincoln's Inn, were a top-notch firm. The senior partner, W.H. Winterbottom, was official solicitor to the Supreme Court, the last to combine that office with private practice. He was also a deacon at Kensington Chapel, where Horne had ministered before moving to Whitfield's. The junior partner, also William Winterbottom, and destined to become senior partner in due course, acted for Horne. He had joined Kensington Chapel during Horne's ministry there. He married into a Kensington Chapel family. Now he was a member at Lyndhurst Road, Hampstead, whose minister, R.F. Horton, who had incidentally never been ordained, was one of Horne's firmest ministerial friends. The younger Winterbottom was prudent as well as up to date. He was also diligent, because he had located a possible source for the John and Mary Bull story, and he could now see clear grounds to take proceedings for slander. "When I saw you at the house," he wrote to Horne, as a consequence, "I understood that this was the course you would wish to take, but I would like you to confirm this. Perhaps you would ring me up on the telephone tomorrow. I shall be here till 11 o'clock and again in the afternoon." That suggests a splendidly leisured lunch. Surely at the National Liberal Club, where I think Winterbottom descendants are still members. He went on. "I have at last discovered the election song which appeared in the Manchester Guardian. It is awful doggerel, but I thought you might like to see it and enclose the page upon which it appears. It is a little difficult to imagine how this march could meet with great success in any constituency." Horne won his case. It was foolhardy to tangle with Edwardian Congregationalism's legal and ministerial foresights. But does this bullish introduction justify our return visit to Charles Sylvester Horne, even in this election year, beyond the fact that for all historians, as for all archaeologists, every human being is worth revisiting? Charles Sylvester Horne was born 150 years ago this year, 15th April 1865. He died 100 years ago last year, 2nd May 1914. He was in his 49th year. And the outlines of his career suggest a life that was at once representative and distinguished. Graduate of the University of Glasgow, trained for ministry at Mansfield College, Oxford, where he was one of the first students, minister at two contrasting but important London churches, Kensington Chapel and Whitfield's Tabernacle, Tottenham Court Road. Chairman of the Congregational Union of England and Wales, that is to say its chief representative figure, 1910 to 11. Liberal MP, Ipswich, 1910 to 14. And that last is arguably what sets him apart. He was also an author, as most prominent ministers were. A stream of pamphlets, articles, a novel, popular histories, contributions to faith and order. On the face of it, there is enough here to justify the Times obituary, the entries in Albert Peel's Congregational 200, as well as our own more recent Who They Were, and perhaps the extension to the Dictionary of National Biography. Admittedly, he only made that by way of its Missing Persons volume. He was also in Who Was Who. I think the parliamentary presence ensured that. And then indeed the admiring biography by the man who at the time of Horne's death was principal of his not-so-old theological college, and was about to assume the chair of the Congregational Union, which Horne had so recently occupied, W.B. Selby. But then that was then, a century ago. Is a century reason enough for rediscovery? Now, for those here of a certain age, as many of us are, it probably is. Had he lived to a good contemporary span, certainly to the 1930s, the 1940s, possibly the 50s, he would have entered the lifespan of many of us here. He certainly did by reputation and association, to start with his family. His widow died in 1958. His second son died in 1983. His third daughter, the last of her generation, in 1984. His youngest son, Kenneth Horne, was relatively short-lived. He died in 1969, but of course his fame lives on. His celebrity, a tantalizing mirror image to that of his father. His was the subversively authoritative mahogany voice of radio comedy in its golden age. To move from family to fellowship. Horne was called to Kensington Chapel as minister when he was still 22. Its members then included a 16-year-old girl who died still in membership there in 1971. Young William Winterbotham, solicitor, died in 1975, still in membership at Lyndhurst Road. These are long associations, coincidences providing conduits for memory. But what was memorable? Edwardian Congregationalism rejoiced in its pulpit luminaries, above all in London. Certainly not all of them in London. Not all were essentially congregational, though Congregationalism is where they bloomed. R.F. Horton, J.H. Jowett, J.D. Jones, W.B. Selby, P.T. Forsyth, R.J. Campbell, W.E. Orchard, Ayodhya Muse, of course, Radio Baptist, F.B. Meyer. Initials were enough, unless you were Campbell Morgan, or Morgan Gibbon, or Sylvester Hall, Charlie to his family. The congregational minister who welcomed me to Sheffield 50 years ago, recalling his own young London days, remembered Orchard and Horne as the two preachers he most admired. He was confirming what I wanted to hear. In 1904-5, my grandmother was paid companion to two ladies in Hampstead Fitzjohn's Avenue. Her employers were members of Horton's Lyndhurst Road. They expected their staff to attend Lyndhurst Road's Kentish Town Mission. A companion was in an in-between position, neither Lyndhurst Road nor quite Kentish Town. So my grandmother was, accordingly, determined to be neither. And she was baptised, as an adult believer, by F.B. Meyer at Christchurch Westminster Bridge Road, and then attracted to Whitfield's. And there she is at a tea table with her favourite brother in a photograph in the Christian World's Whitfield Supplement, 26 January 1905, 6 years before John Bull got there. And those two are exactly those whom Horne most wanted to attract. Young, idealistic, and radical. Horne's hymn to the Vaudois Mountaineers, "For the might of thine arm we adore thee, O God, our Father's God," hit her historical nerve, and she passed her fondness of it on to me. If I remember the tunes correctly, I did have time to check this before I came. It has to be sung to Vaudois rather than mountain Christians. It survived as 666 in congregational praise, although I fear that Rejoice and Sing proved a step too far. Equally exciting for her was his politics. She recalled two general elections with unalloyed pleasure. The Liberal landslide of 1906, the Labour landslide of 1945, and the fact that Horne became a Liberal MP in 1910, famously the first MP to be also a Congregational Minister in pastoral charge at the same time, since Cromwell's day, and famously asserting that the Commons discussed as many truly religious issues as any church meeting, that ticked as many boxes for her as for me. And that's why at the turn of the 1960s and 70s, I talked to Sheffield University's Free Church Society about Sylvester Horne, and why that talk provided the germ of a chapter in So Down to Prayers, in which I bracketed Horne with a hero of an earlier generation, Baldwin Brown of Brixton, who called it the chapter, No Quest, No Conquest, which was the Whitfield's motto. Now, wise historians should admit to hero worship. And I take comfort in the fact that Geoffrey Nuttall got there long before me. He was born in 1911, some months after John Bull tracked Sylvester Horn to his lair. And as a boy, Nuttall kept a photograph of Horn by his bedside. Horn's story of the LMS, he felt, was a competent digest, but he had a genuine respect for Horn's popular history of the Free Churches. This he regarded as essentially a rigorously based as well as vigorously presented popularization, and none the worse for that. In 1938, Nuttall preached with a view at Old Meeting, Norwich. And while there, he visited Basil Cousins Hardy, cousin of Mrs. Sylvester Horn, pillar of Princes Street, solicitor, antiquarian, member of the Congregational Historical Society, whose transactions Nuttall had just become co-editor of, and of which Sylvester Horn had been a founder member. And the young minister was charmed by Cousin Hardy's 20-year-old elder daughter, and wondered, were he to be called? But he was not called. And Mrs. Sylvester Horn's attractive young cousin was not for him. There was, however, another connection. Geoffrey Nuttall's elder brother was a chartered accountant of Pilkington's, the St. Helens glass manufacturers, chaired by Mrs. Horn's brother-in-law, Austin Pilkington, in the 1920s, and by her nephew, Harry Pilkington, in the 50s. James Nuttall was an office holder for a while at the Congregational Church, not the main one in St. Helens, another one, of which Austin Pilkington, as a leading local resident and the leading local employer, had been the key promoter. Now, such links are not wholly coincidental, and their interest is more than antiquarian, for they map the social fabric. They illustrate and begin to explain the extent and power of fellowship. They hold together the words and accents and theses, indeed the doctrines, the mindsets and relationships that are the reality of fellowship. They are the human face of what Sylvester Horn celebrated as the church by grace established. And that was the title of Horn's autumnal address as chairman of the Congregational Union of England and Wales, delivered at Lyndhurst Road, Hampstead, 11 October 1910. And I want, in a way, so that I won't have time to go into the detail, which I should do, to focus on Horn's two chairman addresses as preceded by an annual report from 6 years earlier. Now, 1910 was by any standards a critical year. The year marked, it has been remarked, the Edwardian turn of mind. It precipitated what, years ago now, a bold historian described as the strange death of liberal England. Well, the king certainly died. There were two general elections, one of which shot Horn into the Commons, while the other held him there. It was the year in which Horn had three platforms, Westminster, Whitfield's, and the Congregational Union. All were congenial as well as challenging. Westminster in 1910 still had more nonconformist, indeed more congregational MPs than at any point before the great watershed of 1906. And in 1910, the Prime Minister, Herbert Henry Asquith, though now long lapsed or lapsing, had been a Congregational Church member and was of unimpeachably solid congregational stock. An uncle of his had married two aunts of Mrs. Horn's, and a determined trawl could compound the connections. Indeed, that uncle's son was a particular friend of Horn's. They travelled abroad together, and Horn went up to the Grand Congregational Church near Halifax in Yorkshire to officiate at his friend's marriage. And years later, I quizzed the bride, then long widowed, about Sylvester Horn. Alas, her memory was of a man who was very nice, kind, and ordinary. I had wanted to hear more than that, even if what makes a man nice, kind, and ordinary is what makes him credible. But my point is that Westminster in 1910 was hardly terra incognita for men of Orme's sort. And in 1910 it was the focus for the most constructive aspects of crisis, reaching to the heart of the Constitution. It was vital to be there. It was also vital to be at Whitfield's. Here was an experiment in Christian constitutionalism. It expressed, as we might put it today, the crisis of being church. It was at once church and mission, fellowship and organization. It could already be quantified as a success. In 1902, shortly before the dissolution of the original church and its reconstitution as a London Congregational Union Central Mission Centre, it attracted a morning congregation of 162, an evening congregation of 253. Here, at the throbbing heart of the empire, said the new mission's first report, the churches alone succeeded in maintaining a somber vacuum. In 1902, Whitfield's, prominent in its situation, fortunate in the fresh popularity of its architecture, I like that, it's one way of describing revamped chapel as gin palace, stood empty. 2 years later, all had changed. Richard Moody Smith was expert in conducting censuses. Whitfield's got him to conduct, unannounced but very carefully prepared all the same, a census of all its services. The selected day was 18 December 1904, a month before the opening of the new Mission Institute. It rained that morning, but it cleared as the day went on. There were 634 at the morning service, 1,337 in the evening, 393 at the afternoon men's meeting, and 226 at the women's meeting's annual tea the following evening. All told, 2,461 men, women and children had been counted at Whitfield's that Sunday. It is enough, commented the report, that thousands of persons of all ages, of almost every class, have been drawn within the circle of a strenuous Christian community. Interestingly, even at Whitfield's, women outnumbered men at the morning and evening services, and there was a surprisingly small number of children. The 33 counted at the morning service, exactly the same number as in 1902. And the afternoon Sunday school attracted only 84 children, plus 13 teachers, 7 of the men. It was further noted that after the men's meeting, 250 stayed on for tea at fourpence each. And after the evening service, when every space was filled and some had to stand while others were sent seatless away, 300 stayed on for the social hour. I wonder if that is in fact where my grandmother and her brother were photographed. Those teas were a Whitfield's feature. Every payment is receipted by a cheque torn from a book by the waitress. No tipping is allowed, and what is more, no tipping takes place. So you see, the atmosphere was at once businesslike and homelike and modern. We must follow our own gleam by the light of which we have arrived at the firm conviction that the separate treatment of the sexes, whether in education or in religion or in recreative institutions, is at once unscientific and unnecessary. And if this threatened, as some claimed, the Puritan Sunday, then it was a fact that for most of our congregation there never has been any Puritan Sunday, at any rate since they came to London. The Puritan Sunday presupposed a home. Hence the Sunday afternoon and evening teas. No addresses at the afternoon teas. Conversation is quite as sacred as preaching, and there is more dialogue in the Gospels than sermons. And at the evening teas, smoking was allowed. There's more. This report is for 1903-4. A Tory government was in power. And there's a critical edge, a social realism, in what's now being described. I wonder if you can catch it in the rhetoric of the report. The budget of a church is similar to the budget of a nation or the budget of a local authority. There is an ecclesiastical as well as a national or municipal socialism. If the church is to be institutional, where hitherto it has only been devotional, the effect must be a larger expenditure per unit of congregation, at which feels the church has to undertake the restoration of home life, which pitiless economic conditions have destroyed. The congregation is smartly dressed. It should be known that to the shop assistant, a saving upon the wardrobe would be followed by dismissal. Dress is as much a professional expense as a brass plate in Harley Street. Their appearance is their only title to the precarious freehold of a situation. Well, that is actually radical language. And when the impossibly grand Lord Rosebery was unable to accept the invitation to attend the Institute stone laying, and its place was taken by Mrs. Horne's useful family connection, Mr. Asquith, in opposition now, of course, but a past Home Secretary all the same, he entered engagingly in his speech into the spirit of this radical Christian constituency. "I suppose," he said, "many of us here, I'm afraid a majority of us, are what would be called radicals in politics or in ecclesiastical affairs, or some of us possibly in both. I think I see one or two on this platform who might satisfy that description." He doesn't quite, being a clever politician, identify with them, but he certainly doesn't repudiate them. Well, this church was moving on. The report was clear about that. The ideal of the last century was self-help. The ideal of this century is mutual help. And we might gloss that with two disparate facts. Samuel Smiles, the author of self-help, the apostle of self-help, who had died that very year, had lived in Kensington for the last 30 years, worshipping at Kensington Chapel. And Margaret Bondfield, later to be the first woman cabinet minister, Labour of course, but in 1904, the assistant secretary of the National Union of Shop Assistants, Warehousemen and Clerks, was, I think at that time, a Whitfield's woman. Some years later, she transferred from Whitfield's to the Weyhouse. Both of them, I'm all but certain, had sat at some point under Sylvester Hall. Had Margaret Bondfield, indeed, put those pertinent words about shop assistants' dress and their appearance into the mind of the editor's letter, the report's editor? And at this point, the authentic voice of Sylvester Horne himself sounds from the first report. Leaving behind the ideals of the last and present centuries, the report caught up with a more distant, but heroic, and still relevant past, and annexed it to the men's meetings and the women's meetings and the boys' and girls' clubs, trained bands, all of them. The Puritanism to which we hark back is the noble conception of life, labour and liberty, which was all music to the mind of Milton and all courage to the indomitable soul of Cromwell. We cannot cease to be indifferent towards God without shedding our indifference towards London, England, Empire. just as Cromwell pitted his men of prayer against King Charles's men of birth and breeding, so we must also in our day produce regiments of Ironsides, raised up from among the people themselves, men who have thrown away the tankard in order to seize the sword. But these recruits, filled as they are with the first joy of finding that for them too the world is a battlefield, their lives ready to hand an arduous and daring crusade, it is to accomplish in mid-London what Mr. Meyer is accomplishing south of the Thames. It is to force the ideals of the free churches upon the attention of municipal authorities, labour organisations, and even upon the dull ears of Parliament itself. The men's meetings and the adult schools must as much lay the foundations of a progressive party as the revivals of Wesley, Whitfield and Moody prepared the way for and sustained the strength of the liberalism of the past. If there is reason for believing that one party in the state, by its treatment of the weaker races, by its conception of commerce, by its policy towards the brewing industry, by its reorganisation of education, stands committed to mammon, then we as a community of Christians must seek to inspire the other party in the state with a corresponding passion for humanity and for God. It has been the aim at Whitfield's to show that religion is the basis of trust in the people. Dangerously partisan words, perhaps, but within 6 years their justification seemed to be at hand. Within a year, indeed, of his stone-laying speech at Whitfield's, Mr. Asquith, past Home Secretary, present minister's wife's cousinly connection, was Chancellor of the Exchequer. Within 4 years, he was Prime Minister. And there was a new Chancellor of the Exchequer then, David Lloyd George, whose rhetoric was even more attuned to that of Whitfield's. The poisonous division between Asquith, the English Congregationalist, when he cared to remember, and Lloyd George, the Welsh Baptist, which he never let drop, was well in the future. And in 1910, both spoke for Horne in his election meetings. But my next concern is Horne's chairmanship of the Union. You are not elected to the chair of the Congregational Union of England and Wales unless you have had the confidence of your ministerial brethren and leading laymen. It followed that you must be nationally known as preacher and speaker. The pulpit and the platform might be added to the college principal's desk. Now, here, statistics help. There were in England and Wales in 1910, I'm rounding them up, 4,700 congregational churches and missions. Those churches had 455,000 members. Their buildings had sittings for 1,700,000 people, 1,700,000 bottoms. Their Sunday schools nurtured just under 670,000 children, taught by 68,000 men and women. There were 2,900 ministers, 293 evangelists and lay pastors, just over 5,000 lay preachers. There were 8 theological colleges in England, 3 in Wales. Together they were training 365 students, and there were upwards of 50 professors and lecturers to do that. Here were Cromwell's Ironsides. And London's trained bands? London was where the pulpit princes reigned, though it remained more mission territory than congregational heartland. Horne's own 2 pastorates exemplified both trends. In 1910, Kensington Chapel had 529 members. There were 18 London congregational churches that were larger, only one of them, R.F. Horton's Lyndhurst Road, topped 1,000 members. At 379 members, Whitfield's was the largest of the 3 London central missions. In what you might call parliamentary and royal London, Westminster Chapel was, thanks to Campbell Morgan, easily the largest, 970 members. In the city temple furnished no statistics. And south of the river, Christchurch, Westminster Bridge Road, Newman Hall's old stamping ground, was, under F.B. Meyer, not even listed in that year's congregational yearbook. The extent of this clout can be seen, I think, in the Congregational Union Council. May 1910, the chairman of the union, remember, was a newly elected MP. The chairman of the council was also an MP. So were five other council members, one of them also newly elected, two of them new in 1906. All of them, of course, are liberals. One of them was man for the Hackney constituency next to Horatio Bottomley. The MPs were comfortably cushioned by the council's JPs, 62 of them drawn nationwide, to which should be added three deputy lieutenants, four county councillors, a privy councillor, three knights and a baronet, so much for the council. Those who represented the individual local churches were notionally more varied, and women, though few, were now among them. But the totality confirmed the respectability. Here was the political nation, vanguard of what was now just about the democracy. Here was Horne's Christian constituency. The Congregational Union's 78th Annual Assembly and its 71st Autumnal were both held in London this year, former in the city, the latter in Hampstead. In both, Horne was among friends. That must be stressed. Whether or not he was a Cromwellian major general, or even a sort of Ironside Prince Rupert, he was not a congregational loose cannon. The May Assembly opened in the Memorial Hall, then under 40 years old. Horne was introduced by his predecessor, J.D. Jones, perhaps his closest ministerial friend, and almost immediately, salutary sign of the transience of celebrity, the name of Horne's successor was announced. A northern layman, Gerard N. Ford, J.P. The silver-tongued Jones and the persuasive Ford were two of Congregationalism's most accomplished fixers. And to press my point about Congregationalism's place in the political nation, it should be noted that Jones's brother, Hayden Jones, had just been elected for Merry Honours, liberal of course, and Ford had an already notable wave-making young great-nephew, John Maynard Keynes. The Keyneses worshipped at the Emmanuel Church, Cambridge. At least Keynes's mother, Ford's niece, was a member. Her minister, H.C. Carter, newly arrived in Cambridge, gave an address at this May Assembly. We, of course, have no time for more than headlines, but as outlined in the yearbook, some were suggested. A resolution, for example, looking ahead to the World Missionary Conference to be held the following month, June 1910, in Edinburgh. And the King had died 3 days before Assembly opened. There was a resolution about this, proposed and seconded by two pulpit princes, Jowett of Carr's Lane, Birmingham, 1,366 members, and Morgan Gibbon of Stamford Hill, 875 members. It wished the new King and Queen a long and gracious reign of unbroken peace. How should we deconstruct the answer to that prayer? The funeral was to be the following week, 17th May. There was also a domestic flurry. R.J. Campbell's new theology was causing shockwaves. The young were excited, the elders less so. My grandmother was now a married woman. Paul remained her hero. He prayed with his eyes open, the blue of his eyes confirming the karma. I think he's there praying. He remained a hero. But Campbell was the one who thrilled my grandfather, and I still have his copy of Campbell's New Theology. Led by my grandmother, the young couple had left the Liberals by then for active Labour politics. That May, New Theology hit assembly. The yearbook's reference to it gives nothing away. By permission of the Assembly, on the understanding that no resolution was put to the vote, the Reverend R.J. Campbell, M.A., made a statement largely of a personal character. The Chairman of the Union, the Reverend C.S. Horne, M.A. M.P., replied, and the incident closed. The day of the matinee arrival had yet to dawn, but Campbell was one of its heralds in our churches. And Horne had handled him beautifully. And that was just as well, because the evening assembly moved from Memorial Hall to Campbell's City Temple. And there, the following morning, immediately after the resolution on the King's death, Horne delivered his May address. His theme was anarchy and brotherhood. Now, there was a clear progression in the two London assemblies of 1910. From anarchy and brotherhood in the City Temple to the church of my grace established in Lyndhurst Road. That church's minister, R.F. Horton, was of course himself the very incarnation of grace. An admirer had likened him to Matthew Arnold turned Salvation Army captain. Autumn assembly opened, however, with an evening sermon from an inspired mouse, W.B. Selby, Horne's future biographer. Horne's own address followed next morning, to be capped that evening by a public meeting on the unity of the Christian Church. The Master of the Rolls, Horne's father-in-law, chaired it. Horne was one of the three speakers. The others were J.H. Shakespeare, Secretary of the Baptist Union, already the most commanding of the new generation of free church leaders, and Hensley Henson, Canon of Westminster, Rector of St. Margaret's, that I'm sure is how Horne wheeled him in, future bishop. There could not have been a more daringly authoritative figure. And so to Horne's two addresses. The first to my friends and comrades, the second to brethren and comrades, which moderator of General Assembly would now dare to address his years, comrades. You could do it in 1910. Dare! 100 years later. They were printed in the yearbook. Inevitably, the printed version lacks the immediacy of the spoken occasion, the rapport between speaker and hearers. The general consensus was that Horne, at his best, was without parallel as a platform speaker. There was also a retrospective agreement that the incessant demands of platform oratory had taken their toll. The magic was going from his voice, and the rare flexibility which enabled him to switch from platform to pulpit, and now required him to adjust to the House of Commons, came less easily. There remains, however, plenty of evidence as to his spoken power, the interaction of personality, passion, voice, humour, intelligence, intellect, the sheer surprise of it all. The man who, from student days, so entranced his correspondents when he bothered to write, and his travelling companions, and took such a delight in motor cars and games of golf, carried those qualities appropriately into public worship and public debate, and a chairman's address came somewhere between the two. Horne's addresses, at first reading, read ponderously. When you try to make notes from them, you begin to realise how much there is in them, actually. But just reading, trying to read them quickly, I think, where's this going? Make those from them, this is different to them. They're made of them. Well, of course they are. Whatever the acoustics of the City Temple and Lyndhurst Road, these were pre-microphone days. This was still Edwardian England. The patterns of oratory were still Gladstonian, mediated now by Asquith, Though now, above all in 1910, they were illuminated by Lloyd George, but Midlothians still had the edge on Limehouse in serious circles. The serious orator had to ensure fellow feeling. He needed to accumulate weight and emotion as he carried you with him. He might then inject humour, and all that is there. The humour lurks steadily, it can gleam unexpectedly. The references are up to date, and it is the up to dateness which gives the addresses their political edge. The adroit use of phrases like passive resistance, the engagement with words like militarism, socialism, democracy. There are surprisingly few sound bites, that's a pity. Perhaps the best sound bites come with the hecklers. They're matters of perfectly pitched timing. Hall in 1910 had no God damn the Sultan moment, though some of his hearers in the city temple must have heard Joseph Parker electrify that building with those words less than 20 years before. And Horne certainly had his own moments. He did alight on another occasion, one journalistic connoisseur, with the assertion, suddenly came out, the only difference between a grave and a groove is a matter of depth. What Horne did provide in 1910, however, was passionate consistency. He said nothing he had not said before, but now he could say it with a new authority, as perhaps the platform shared with Shakespeare and Hensley Henson, chaired by the master of the roles, made clear. Here was a sighting of the church, as by grace most truly established. And the passion glowed through the distinctive historical sense which permeated both addresses. Horne spoke as a Cromwellian Ironside, a Mayflower pilgrim, and Elizabethan separatist. And if there lay his view of history, he was bound to speak politically. But his history did not stop there. Victorian Congregationalists were always engagingly fond of stressing their contemporary radicalism in politics and their very conservative fidelity to the ecclesiology of the Apostolic Church. That essentially was Horne's theme in 1910. It was old-fashioned Congregationalism, though, as Horne phrased it, this Congregationalism had a grand, authentic Catholicity to it. Here was the Church. With Puritans as his stepping stone, he leapt across the ages to annex the idea of the church for the congregational future of his friends, brethren, and comrades. He is, in fact, articulating the congregationalism which inspired Geoffrey Nuttall to apply his scholarship to the Holy Spirit in Puritan faith and experience, his Oxford DD, and then to visible sense. That, I think, is the link between the two. Now, I am going to skip over, because it is actually, I think, extremely interesting, but that is not by any stretch of imagination time, to look at the language of those two addresses, and to realise how, I think, how clever it is, and how apt it is, and eventually how enthralling it is. But I think it's time to come to a conclusion. 4 years after these two addresses, there's just one point I'll give at the very end. At the very end of his Church is by Grace Established, you remember the king has been, Edward VII has been buried. George V's coronation is going to be the following June. So everybody's looking forward to the king is dead, God save king, new king. Horne at the end of his address dares to dot the Commonwealth eyes. In October 1660, he reminds his audience, some of the regicides, among them Hugh Peters, Cromwell's chaplain, met their deaths. Remember, as Horne is speaking, the king's coronation is 8 months away. It's a brave thing to draw attention to a few regicide deaths. we may raise our heads, he says, in gratitude and pride, and thank God that the men who 250 years ago, this very week, suffered at Charing Cross for the rights of the common people, were nurtured in the bosom of our churches. 4 years after that, Olmsted, he collapsed on board a steamer, taking him essentially from the States, I think from Niagara. He'd been there, not in Niagara, in the States, lecturing at Yale on the romance of preaching. And he was going to Toronto. And he dropped down suddenly. His death came as the sharpest, cruelest of shocks. For the English-speaking Christian world at large, he was still in his prime. For those who knew him best, he had reached his own point of crisis. He planned, though it was not yet, I think, fully public, to leave Whitfield's and to leave Parliament. His future, therefore, was unclear. It pointed, most likely, to a roving advocacy of brotherhood. That insistent word, it comes through those two addresses, and so Adolphe writes, heartwarming, bonding concept. The advocacy of brotherhood in the interests of peace and justice worldwide. Well, who knows, 1914. How am I to sum him up? I am conscious that even if I had all the time in the world, I would have left too much unsaid. And I have done. In providing his context, I said too little about his own family background, the Horns, because they expressed market town congregationalism, congregationalism's ministerial seedbed. From the late 18th to the late 20th centuries, there were congregational Horns in Morton and Marsh, Stoneworld and elsewhere. Horn's father was a country town minister turned country town newspaper editor, proprietor, bookseller. One of Horn's brothers was a farmer who stood twice for Parliament, once of them in 1906. The other brother moved to London, became a senior civil servant. Two first cousins were LMS missionaries in India. Their nephew, Hampton Horn, entered the congregational ministry. He served in country churches, but also in London's East End. He succeeded Frank Lenwood, notorious for Jesus, Lord and Leader, at Green Gates, Plaistow. And Hampton Horn worked for peace, serving on the Fellowship of Reconciliation in the 1940s as its regional and general secretary. I've said very little about Horn's wife. Sylvester Horn was famously a man's man, as Mrs. Bull intimated. But Catherine Horn was an integral part of Whitfield's and of his work. In her own right, she was, I think, a remarkable woman. I've said too little about Horn at Westminster. It's been too easily assumed he hadn't met expectations. I'm not convinced about that. Neither have I examined fully his concept of brotherhood and its organisational dimension. Was that simply, as has since been generally said, and as I've implied elsewhere, the froth of optimistic Christian liberal socialism? And what of his writings? There was more to that than I've indicated. He was certainly more than the Enid Blyton of ecclesiastical history that Gordon Rupp once famously called him. What I'm clear about, however, is the vigour of his intellect and his thinking and the consistency of their expression. There was so much more to him than expert packaging for pulpit and platform that I find it hard to believe that he really would have cast either congregational churchmanship or political life permanently aside had he lived. They had been too much part of his being from the very first. And I don't think it will now do to portray him as the champion of a swiftly outmoded progressivism, except in the sense that the keenest activists are bound to be outmoded before their time. That's the destiny of all true ministers of the gospel. I can believe that in May 1914 his work was done. His health, for a start, had for years been very uncertain. the strains of Free Church ministry, remember, had killed the Congregational Charles Berry at Wolverhampton, the Methodist Hugh Price Hughes, R.W. Dale, Joseph Parker, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, all, although they lived longer, died before their time, naturally. Sylvester Horne ranks with them. And had he lived? One, of course, should never second-guess the future. And for those alive in May 1914, the future was to be unimaginably twisted. Not all would revert to business as usual. Come August 1914, would Horne's passion for brotherhood, voiced, remember, in such soldierly language, and some very uncomfortable soldierly language in one of his chairman's addresses, would that have taken him to war, and if so, what sort? And had he then survived the flu epidemic of 1918-19, would his political instincts have taken him at last into labour politics? His liberal activist youngest son thought not. I'm not so sure. P.T. Forsyth preached at Horne's funeral. He rose to the occasion, and his words should end this occasion. They are pure Forsyth, but they fit Horne to perfection, as he dwelt on the sharp crisis of our brother's end. There is in Padua a fresco by Giotto of Christ's resurrection, in which he seems almost shooting upward from the tomb, his face impatient to leave the world and return to his Father. And we can think of this soul now taking his way through that heavenly place to his Lord's side, with more than all the raptness he spent on his Lord's cause here. In the lives of true saints and great wrestlers with God, there come times when they wish to pray no more. It is not weariness, nor impatience, nor despair. It is the other way. It is fruition. In that day ye shall ask me nothing. It is not even repose. It is the old energy in a new and higher form. It is praise. It is adoration. We just worship. So death comes to such a soul as once filled this clay before us. Here his life was a divine, sleepless importunacy. But all that now gives way. Quest ends in conquest.